Well, good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Good to see you all out there in the chat box. It's been, the run-up to the show has not gone completely as anticipated, so I'm still trying to get myself set up here, so I'm going to play another couple of tunes before getting into tonight's main talky bits. I've got, coming up, I've got a recorded interview I did with a man called Orion Martin earlier on in the week. He's busy developing a thing called the Sidekick application for smartphones, which are designed at the push of a button to stream whatever it is that the camera is filming or recording directly onto secure servers on the internet so that it can be kept safe should it be needed for any other purpose in the future. And also, at the push of another button, it will actually stream it straight onto a live website so that people can watch what's actually going on around the phone at the time. I'm sure that several of you can imagine how useful this might be at some points. The inimitable and as yet unimitated Led Zeppelin there, and nobody's fault but mine. Well, we've got a bit of a yawning gap in the second half of tonight's show. I was planning on having a recorded conversation with a man called Ambassador David Williams, who spent 30,000 hours of his time examining freedom, liberty, the real history of the world, treaties, constitutions, the right to self-determination, and many other subjects which I think would be absolutely fascinating to the people out there on People's Internet Radio. But unfortunately he was feeling slightly peaky and not up to dealing with this kind of doctor at any rate. We did have a quick chat though, and he will be on the show in the future, and having had a bit of a chat, he's agreed to come on live as well, so at least we'll get the benefit of having him in the chat box, and we'll be able to ask him questions and stuff, because really, I've been steeping myself in what there is of his material on the internet over the last two or three days, and there's quite a lot of truly jaw-dropping gear in there, so I'm not really quite sure what I'm going to do with the second part of the show, although I suppose it would make sense to play maybe a couple of pods of some of the stuff I listened to of his that I found particularly entertaining. The first half of the show, though, I have, as I said a bit earlier, an interview with a man called Orion Martin. I'll stick a link to it in the, because he's got a video up on YouTube, which is absolutely pretty shocking, really. But what I'll do, I'll tell you what, I'll just let him speak for himself. So this is an interview that I recorded earlier on in the week. He wasn't able to come on live, but we did have quite an extensive chat. I think in these days when it seems that the technology is being very much used to spy on us and to work to our disadvantage, you'll probably be able to hear that I really enjoyed this interview, listening to a character who is one amongst many, it seems, who's developing uses for the technology which might actually be working to our advantage. So here's one Orion Martin, and I will be back with you in an hour or so. Thanks a lot for agreeing to chat with me about this, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, Phil, thanks for contacting me.
Not a problem. Very exciting project, I'd say. So it's really, I was really impressed by the idea behind your the app that you're proposing to launch, and absolutely fascinated, and I think it's showing a great amount of courage. Perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself. Is that possible?
Sure. See, I was in the Army for several years, and after that I got my real estate license and worked fairly briefly, actually, as a loan officer in Silicon Valley. And let's see, then I went to school, but by that point, I had kind of inverted the goal for, you know, what I did day to day, and I was really absorbed in research. So I basically stopped focusing on, you know, career advancement or anything like that, and basically just focused on research. And
what were you researching into?
Well, it's the same stuff, you know, when people start, you know, waking up or realizing that their preconceived notion of how the world works is not necessarily mesh with reality. Some people just want to learn more and research and find out, you know, what's the extent of the disconnect between what they had previously thought and what reality actually is. And so I basically just researched all kinds of topics, economics, history, psychology, and then a big part of it is the increasing police state. That's been going on for some time now.
Yes, I'm aware. I think you're somewhere ahead of us over in the US. I think you're probably 2 or 3 years ahead of where we are. I was pretty shocked by some of the stuff that was shown at the start of your video.
That was not my first iteration when I was making the series of clips. I actually had to tone it down. I tested some of the earlier clip collections with some people I know, and it was too graphic, like far too graphic. So that's really the light version.
Blimey, that's pretty disturbing, because the stuff that's on there is pretty outrageous.
Yeah, and that's the real problem, is that this kind of behavior is basically become institutionalized. Now, that's not to say that all police officers engage in that, but at the same time, the percentage of officers who do engage in that kind of behavior, it's attacking people, gross violations of the rights, sometimes even straight up murder. That number has just been increasing, the number of police officers who behave that way. And it's really just one of the hallmarks of a police state as it increases. And I think it's important to, at the very least, acknowledge that that is actually happening, because there is a kind of a shockingly large percentage of the population, at least in the U.S., who still adheres to the bad apple theory, that there are basically just more cameras around and more of these kind of incidents, as people call them, are being caught. So that posted to YouTube and whatnot, but it doesn't really it doesn't mesh with the facts that the SWAT raids have just skyrocketed, and it's really just across the board.
Yeah, and really the examples you show at the beginning of your video, most of those people are not even given a chance to even start resisting. They just appear to be attacked outright and almost immediately.
Right. It happens all the time. It's the unfortunate fact, is that it happens all the time. And again, this goes back to public perceptions. So, the average American now watches a little over 5 hours of television a day, and a high number of those shows are cop shows, and they have a view of the relationship between the state and the public that doesn't quite, I don't think, match reality. So, for example, how I got started with all of this was that a friend of mine was pretty savagely beaten by three police officers, and he was laying on the ground afterwards. He was still conscious, and he heard the officers, they were discussing with each other how to, they were saying, has our assault been recorded somehow? Are the cameras in the lot did this guy have an audio recorder in his truck, or maybe his cell phone was activated to record? So they ransacked his truck and didn't find anything. And once they did that, they were free to proceed with what has pretty much become standard operating procedure, which is charge their victim with a crime that they committed. So they charged my friend with assaulting police officers and resisting arrest. And I was at his trial. And it was kind of an eye-opener, because I'd never sat in or viewed anything like that. And the jury actually wound up finding my friend guilty, even though all of the evidence clearly showed that he was the one who had been beaten, pictures of him just covered in bruises and cuts. And, the officers had to make up a story, right? And they couldn't keep their story straight, that those conflicted. And, none of it really mattered in the end, because I think a lot of it had to do with the perception that the public has about what happens in a courtroom. And I think the default position is that anybody who's sitting in the defendant's seat is guilty, and that the judge and the DA, or the prosecuting attorney, they have to be somehow right, that they're somehow better, that they're the ones who are on the side of good. And I think that a lot of what's happening right now is that there's the schism between people who are saying, hey, there's really something wrong going on here. The cops are becoming more militarized and aggressive. And then this other part of the public whose perception is, I think, a bit off, who basically say that it's not really an issue.
And did the jury reach that conclusion of their own account, or were they given instructions by the judge, just as a matter of interest?
Yeah, really good question. Yeah, the judge, I would say, was, fairly biased. And I'm not going to say that the judge ordered them to come to that conclusion. I think that it's actually more a sign of how far along we are in terms of the way that people view the police state being manipulated. So.
Okay, so it was partly the jury and partly, I mean, it's easy for the judge to guide the jury, isn't it? Even though it's not actually his job so to do.
Oh, sure, of course. He's in a great position of power. People would automatically defer to the judge. You know, anybody who wants to look into studies on, you know, how people interact with authority figures or people they perceive as authority figures, should look up the Stanford Prison Experiment and the Milgram, where basically people will just automatically obey.
Yes, because the Stanford Prison Experiment was the one, wasn't it, where perhaps you could just remind people about that. Was that was the one where they had a bunch of students and they kind of divided some of them into prisoners and the others into role-playing law enforcement officers. Am I remembering correctly?
Yes, that's correct. And it was supposed to be this long-term experiment, and it only after, I think it was, just a couple of days, the professor who was running it had to stop it, cancel it, because people became the roles that they were assigned. So the prisoners became the prisoners, and they viewed the guards as higher than them, above them, and the guards viewed themselves as being better than the prisoners. And there was the mistreatment, the kind of sadism that automatically popped out once people assumed those roles was really shocking to people who were running the experiment. And then the Milgram experiment is actually a shock experiment to see how far people will go when it comes to obeying someone who they perceive to be an authority figure. So there was somebody who was strapped into a chair, and they were part of the experiment. They were acting. And then there was the test subject. And the whole thing was, the whole scenario was that a scientist, a psychologist, was basically running an experiment, a memory experiment, if I recall correctly. And the actual test subject was the one who had to apply an electric shock when this person didn't get the answer right, when they didn't recall correctly. And the whole experiment was rigged so that the shocks would have to increase and increase and increase to the point of lethal shock. And a huge percentage of the test subjects actually just went all the way. They did it, and they actually, they were so racked by I guess you'd call it cognitive dissonance, the clash between what they know is right and then the urge to obey an authority figure created almost like a sense of hysteria in these subjects, which really goes to show you how strong that impulse is in human beings to obey.
Yeah, and in that case, I think the authority figure was a man in a white coat with a clipboard, wasn't he? Who was encouraging them to carry on.
That's exactly it, yeah. And, the interesting thing is that even in that experiment, the researcher is, his only real authority comes from being an academic or a scientist. When you throw in the perceived authority of government, then the obedience factor really just skyrockets from there. And I think that's part of the reason why we're in our current situation today and why I think we're heading where we're heading.
Interestingly, I think somebody did a slight update on that second experiment where they introduced another actor in there who basically refused, some of the actors refused to go up the shock level. And the result they found was that in the original experiment where kind of 9 out of 10 people just administered the shock, if they were set the example of an actor refusing to administer shock, then 90% of them jumped that way, which I thought was a very interesting development on the thing, because it shows how much we're conditioned by what's actually happening around us as well.
Oh, right. I think that goes along with the Ash conformity experiments, where there would be one test subject and multiple people, and they were given lines, and the test was really simple. Are these lines the same length, or which line is longer or shorter than the others, and it was made quite obvious. And there was only one test subject. Everyone else was an actor. And so what they would do is they would have the actors pick the wrong line and see if that altered the decision of the actual test subject. And surprisingly, you know, it did. It actually altered that. And so I think that it can go the other way too. You know, if there's an example of resistance, then I think that can, you know, there's a tipping point for that, where if there's an example of resistance and there are enough people who are, you know, saying no, then I think there is a tipping point and everything shifts the other way.
That gives us a bit of a cause for optimism, really, doesn't it? Because it shows how easily the situation might be reversed if we start acting rather than ignoring what's happening to us.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we're at the point now where it's, I'll put it this way, you know, there's a type of learning called the trivium. And it's just based on the idea of, you know, the same idea of a computer processor, that there are different stages of learning, and the first is taking in information, and then the second is processing it, and then the third is outputting, you know, whether it's, you know, a solution or what have you. And I think that for a long time now, we've really been focused on taking in information, and that's really important. It always has to happen. But then if people stay on it too long, then they don't move on in the process. And we have to, if we're going to come to the final product, which is solutions which are then acted upon and made real. And I think that we need to have, and we do have, I've noticed a big uptick in people developing technologies or, you know, projects locally or, you know, organizations just over the last couple of years. I think there's really been a huge increase, and so I think that it is reason for optimism.
Yes, yeah, indeed. So your response to all of this was to start developing a smartphone application, which you're calling Sidekick. Perhaps you'd like to tell us about that.
Sure. So it really started after my friend was found guilty at the trial. I was just asking myself, what would these jurors need to have seen to arrive at a different conclusion? And it became clear that there was really only one thing that could alter their view, which would be, you know, video evidence or, you know, audio evidence or both of the officers, you know, walking up and smashing the window and beating him. So, but the problem that I saw was that the officers knew that that was their weak spot, and they ransacked his truck specifically for that purpose. So in order for the event to be captured, the individual who's filming would need to have that data streamed as it's recorded to some kind of server, right?
Yeah.
And for my friend, that would have been sufficient because he is quite knowledgeable in his rights, and you know, he's had encounters with police before, and every time before that, he had been calm enough and knowledgeable enough to walk away from the situation. There was no escalation of force or anything. And, so that this time was kind of an abnormality, for him. But so even though the information, even though just the ability to record the event might have been enough for him, I don't think it would have been enough for most people. Which is understandable. Most people don't know their rights, and when it actually comes to the point where there's, you know, an officer of the state armed and willing to do you harm, who's, you know, a couple feet away from you and intimidating, people tend to crumble, and it's totally understandable. So,
especially if they've got no alternative means to resort to.
Exactly. I mean, you know, using lethal force to defend yourself against illegal aggression is generally considered okay, but not when it comes to police officers. Yeah. And I don't think it's a very smart, practical thing to do, really. You know, even if it is morally justified, I don't think it's really any kind of solution. You know, violence is their game. Violence is not a trait that I have found among freedom-minded individuals. Most people who I've encountered adhere to the non-aggression principle, right? You don't initiate force.
Yeah, we've recognized that staying peaceful is one of the most important things that must be done. Presumably those are the kind of techniques that were being used by your friend up to this point, were they?
Right. And so basically I wanted to come up with a solution that was peaceful, you know, basically agorist in nature. Mm. And once I meshed a solution for not having a legal knowledge of, you know, the rights and how the system functions, that was the solution to that's basically an attorney, right, who can come on the phone on a video call. And once I meshed those two ideas together, it became pretty clear how that app could help people not have their rights violated, right? I'm not saying that it's going to absolutely prevent it, but I'm saying that I saw how it could help prevent that, you know, increase your chances of not being beaten or, you know, not being falsely arrested. But it was probably another year or so before I realized how it could be used to deal with the police state on a larger level. So there's how it affects the individual, and then there's, you know, when they're actually using the application. But then there's how I think it will deal with the police state on really a countrywide level and beyond. I don't think this is limited to the United States. And that is, I think, probably the best example of this is Maywood, California. So in June of 2010, early June, the city of Maywood, California received a notice from their insurance carrier saying that their coverage was being dropped. Now, there were a list of reasons, but the primary reason given was the number of claims against the police department, bearing in mind that the police department is covered underneath the city's umbrella of insurance. So if the police department has a bunch of claims and increases the risk to the insurance policy, then the carrier will eventually reach a point where they'll just drop the insurance. But it doesn't just drop the police department, it drops the entire city government.
All of their insurance cover was withdrawn.
Right. The whole city government's insurance cover was withdrawn. Wicked. And they really can't operate without insurance. If it's kind of a boring subject, but if people think about it, pretty much the part of what helps life move along smoothly and decrease risk is insurance. So this is why, you know, ships don't leave the port without insurance, planes don't take off without insurance, houses aren't built. You know what I mean? It's kind of an underlying safety net for society. And cities really can't, you know, if they operate without insurance, then even a single claim could cost them millions and destroy their budget. And so if you talk about the number of claims that were put up against the Maywood City Police Department, that would completely bankrupt the city. So they really need insurance. So what happened was the city council went out and they went to all these other insurance carriers and they were shot down each time. They were told, no, this we can't insure you. Look at all the claims against your police department. So the LA Times interviewed one of the council members, Felipe Aguirre, and he told them, nobody will insure us, not as long as we have the Maywood Police Department. So they only had 30 days. So when 30 days came and went, they fired the entire 60-member police department. And then after that, the city contracted out law enforcement to the county, the LA County Sheriff's Department. But I think it's just really important to note, to just not let this go by, that it just claims, you know, a lot of these weren't even settled cases. They were just claims that had been filed against the police department. They just piled up a little bit. It hit the breaking point for the insurance carrier. And it's just this chain reaction where the only result that can really happen at the end is for the entire police department to get fired. So this is something, basically Sidekick is designed to mass produce this. And this isn't just Maywood. This has happened several times just in the last few years. So the app is designed to help someone when they're being faced with a situation, right, personally on their individual level. And then on a larger level, if enough people are using it in a given jurisdiction, then if the police department is, if the police officers in a department are violating people's rights, then I would say that it's pretty much inevitable that the cases will build up, and then the city and the police department will have to answer to the insurance carrier.
So the basic idea of the first part of the app is that the audio and the video of whatever activities is happening by the roadside get streamed to a secure server on the web and so can be produced as evidence in court.
Right. It'll be streamed to several secure servers, and hopefully if decentralized data storage is complete by the time that we launch, then we'll also store it on decentralized data storage. But then also the app user will have the choice if they want to have their interaction be viewable to the public live, then they can select that. So when they activate the application and it begins streaming that data, it will also get sent to the Sidekick website so that there will be a page on the site that anybody can go to and see videos just popping up, and each one will be a live encounter. It's just a live streamed video, and it'll show where it's taking place. People can will be able to comment and upvote and downvote and, you know, send it out on social networks. So I think it's going to, I think that's actually going to be a pretty big hammer blow to perception.
I think that's really clever. I wasn't aware of that aspect of it, because that, of course, means that you're starting to at least provide a tool which might change public opinion as well.
Right. And you know, I think it's a lot easier for a live streamed video to go viral. There's something about it happening.
Yeah, I agree.
In the present moment. And so I don't know if you are aware, but in the US there's a show called Cops. Have you heard of this?
I have heard of it. Yeah, we have similar we have similar shows in the UK, I gather.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the way that I think of this live streaming is basically it's just a live version of Cops in reverse.
That's a really cracking idea, that is.
Yeah. And there are a lot of other features, you know, such as end call security. There are measures that people can take so that the officer can't just take their phone and shut down the app. There's another level that people can use where they need to enter in a PIN number in order to shut down the app. And when the app's on and it hasn't been shut down, it'll lock down your phone so you can't turn it off with the power button. So you need to close down the phone by closing down the app first. So people can opt to have a PIN that needs to be put in order for the program to shut down. And then beyond that, there's two-stage authentication. So let's say that somebody is threatened by an officer, give me your PIN so I can shut your phone down. They're basically being coerced into giving up a PIN. Well, if they choose the highest level of end call security, then they can go ahead and just comply. They can hand over their phone, give the officer their PIN, and when the officer goes to put the PIN in, the phone won't shut down because the attorney on the other side will have their own PIN that they will need to enter in order for the app to shut down. And bearing in mind that that entire interaction was just recorded and streamed to secure servers. So.
Yeah. So what about, so that's the next bit of the app really, is the fact that it will seek out an attorney. How does that part of it work?
Right. Yeah. So there are a lot of, technical and logistical issues that needed to be worked out, and this is one of the main ones. And it's basically a series of steps. It's how the attorney network is set up. So first, I had to determine how many subscribers could an attorney on the attorney network reasonably cover. And I really dug through the numbers of the Bureau of Justice statistics detailing the number of stops per people who have a driver's license, and it just went on and on from there. And I eventually wound up with a ratio of 1 to 400. So one attorney on the network can reasonably provide coverage to 400 people, because it's still somewhat rare for people to get pulled over. The average in the U.S., I was surprised the number is actually this high, but it's the average licensed driver gets pulled over once a year. That's what the average is.
Really?
So
once a year.
The average is once a year for being pulled over.
Wow. I guess that's probably unevenly distributed in that several people get pulled over many times.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm sure there are plenty of statistical outliers which don't make that number quite as accurate, but that is what the average comes out to. And from that, I was able to figure out, okay, the average traffic stop is 20 minutes, and just went on from there, and ultimately came to the ratio of 1 to 400. So when we start the network, what we're going to do is, as each attorney comes on, we're going to allow the next 400 subscribers to have that aspect of their app activate. Mm-hmm. So just as a side note, this is the part that people would have to pay a subscription for, and we're looking at about $60 a year, so it comes out to $5 a month, to be able to send out, to get legal representation 12 times in a year. So they can use the audio video with attorney option 12 times in a year.
And you do have the choice, don't you, to either just stream it live or to use the attorney option as well.
Right, and you can switch back and forth. So let's say that there's a thing going on in the U.S., been going on for a little while now, and it's called cop blocking, and it's people who go out and film police interacting with other people. So they're basically trying to keep a record of police interactions with other people. And, you know, if they can catch something, that actually happens a lot, that what they catch on film is, you know, a rights violation or, you know, a blatant violation of the law. So those people really wouldn't need an attorney, right? They would just want to stream the audio and video.
Yeah.
And they can do that. So if they just tap stream audio and video, then it'll just stream audio and video, and they can have it go live or not. It's up to them. And that's free, right? So the app will be free to download, and that aspect of the app will be free to use. But then if somebody wants to get legal representation or connected to legal representation, then that would be the subscription that they would need to get. And there's no, this is a question that a lot of people have, you know, how am I going to pay the attorney? Well, you don't have to pay the attorney. This is something that attorneys normally pay for. They actually pay a lot of money to get information on people who either need or think they might need legal representation. It's called the lead generation business model. And there are, you know, whole aspects of professions which rely solely on this business model.
And I guess this way they're getting contacted by people who definitely need legal representation in the moment.
Right. So in terms of the quality of the lead, psychic is going to be a gold mine for attorneys. This is kind of a dream job. You know, they don't have to go pay a bunch of money to, you know, have a nice office in a firm. They can operate out of a home office if they want, and they can just take calls all day. And knowing that there's a decent portion of those calls on which they're going to have documented evidence of a code violation or a rights violation. And then if they do a good enough job representing their client, then their client will choose them to prosecute that lawsuit.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. It's really, there are a lot of built-in safeguards to make sure that the attorneys have the right motivation to represent their clients to the best of their ability and to take as many calls as possible, because they know that the wider the net they cast, the more valid lawsuits they'll be able to really stack up, and they'll be able to build their client base and the number of cases that they're litigating.
I guess if nothing else, it also means that the fee of $5 a month or whatever it works out to be, that you get yourself live representation at the roadside via the phone. Is that right?
Exactly. So it's a win-win situation. The app user will get legal representation when they need it, and the attorney is just increasing the chances of taking the call that that's going to be a big lawsuit for them.
Mm. Yeah, and that can work out several ways, can't it? That in itself might prevent it from being necessary to take the lawsuit any further.
Yeah, and I think that that's actually a big thing here, is that I think that this app is going to serve to de-escalate situations which otherwise might have escalated to the point of violence. I think that far fewer officers will tend toward violence, and I think that also far fewer people that officers are interacting with would tend toward violence if the whole situation is being securely documented. And there's a third party, an attorney, licensed to practice law in that state, who's representing their client, but also their real goal is to make sure that the interaction goes according to the codes of that state.
And your friend's experience suggests that the police are well aware of the accountability issue.
Oh, absolutely. There's a big push in the U.S. right now for lapel-worn or glasses-worn body cameras for police. And as if that's a complete solution, like that's just... And it's really not, actually. When people cite the lapel cameras, they typically cite the case study of Rialto, California, where the police chief did a test and he had half of his officers wear lapel cams and the other half did not. And what he found was that the officers who wore the lapel cams had a much lower chance of getting use of force complaints or being in a situation that had escalated the violence. And overall, the overall numbers for the department dropped enough that he said, well, you know, this is going to, you know, save us a lot of trouble, and he mandated it for all officers. But at the same time, there's another case study, and that's Albuquerque, New Mexico. So people who have been following this know that in Albuquerque, the cops have basically been on a killing spree for the last several years, and it all started not that long after the whole department received body cameras.
So how did that work out?
It's because it's not about the cameras. It's about the training, the hiring process. Who do they let go all the way through the application process? How do they train the officers once they get to their department? And what it turns out is that in Rialto, California, the police chief was not a psycho, and he did not want his officers going around and throwing their weight around and harassing people. And he really wanted to have a peaceful community, and so he made sure that his officers were trained that way. And the body cameras just really just served to reinforce that. But in Albuquerque, it was the opposite. Right around that same time, they had brought in a new director of training, and everything became hyper-militarized, hyper-aggressive, and it's directly in line with the increase in police shootings. So a lot of times when these officers get to a place and they're interacting with somebody and they make the decision, I'm going to, you know, beat this person up or tase this person, they'll just turn the lapel camera off, and all they have to do is say it malfunctioned or we lost the footage. So that's really, the lapel cameras are not a solution. Training is primarily why the officers are behaving the way they're behaving.
Once again, that sounds like a very useful experiment that was run there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really happy that the police chief in Rialto did that experiment, because I think it shows that what a police department could be like if they have more of if their goal is peaceful interaction with the public, which, I mean, you can argue how far that's even possible with government run police, but I do like that that's at least his goal.
And also, I guess it gives the insurance companies a bit of a pointer as to what it is they're looking for if they want to be able to insure police departments.
Right. You know, the insurance companies have one bottom line, and that's money. And they want to do whatever they can to make sure that they pay out a heck of a lot less than they take in. And when the numbers don't match up for them, they're fairly cold-blooded about it. They'll either jack up the premiums for, say, a city, as a nudge, you know, in other words, get your police department in line, or else this is going to keep going up, or we might just cancel it entirely. Or an insurance carrier can just give no notice of, you know, ramping up the premiums. They can just cancel the insurance outright. And I'd say that's actually the more common one, is for insurance companies to just cancel the policy outright.
And again, I think that's another really optimistic part of this story and this idea, really, is that insurance companies are starting to operate specifically in the interests of the public, which they're, in my opinion, not always doing.
Right. I mean, the more that things are going wrong in society, the worse insurance companies are. You know, it's typically speaking, right, unless you have some kind of public-private merger of insurance companies like you have, for example, in the health industry in the U.S. But if we're talking about something like, you know, covering a city with insurance, they're pretty separated from that, from the other areas of insurance that are more blended with government. And so, you know, the insurance carrier for a city is really just a lot more concerned about making sure that they're, again, just paying out less than they're taking in. And they want to make that gulf as wide as possible. And when they see that a police department is getting a bunch of claims at them, what they see is risk, and it just keeps on going up. And once it crosses the line, they'll take action.
And there must be a limit to how far they can ramp the charges to a city, a municipal authority.
Oh yeah, there's actually one of the cities that I have in the video that I put up. I didn't show this clip because I wanted to keep the whole video as short as possible. But this city was actually given a rate that was so high that they couldn't afford it. So the insurance carrier didn't drop them. Their first insurance carrier did drop them, but they actually were offered coverage by another company, but it was something like 10 times of what they were paying before, and they couldn't afford it. Mm. But the result was still the same.
So that's likely to lead in fairly short order. If, as you say, it's getting more and more common in the U.S., that's likely to lead to some beneficial results as well.
I think that the most benefit is going to take place if the government-run police departments are replaced by private security forces, which, again, it just seems like everything's really going into warp speed in the last couple of years. But, again, just in the last couple of years, there have been some companies that have popped up that have really established themselves with sterling reputations. So there are some areas of Detroit where the communities have banded together and hired private security, and inevitably, you know, crime just plummets. And, you know, the people aren't being, you know, beaten or threatened or feeling in that constant state of fear that they felt before from the police themselves. There are some towns where it's, like there's a town in Texas, I'll forward you the article, so maybe you could put it in the links, but there's a town in Texas that fired their police department and then hired on, I believe it's called SEAL Security, and, their crime went down 61%. And, wow. You know, bear in mind, you know, some of these security firms have totally, you know, in terms of the concept of policing, very radical ideas. One of the firms in Detroit, I believe, actually has their people go door to door, introduce themselves to everybody, and let them know your life is more valuable than my own.
Wow, that's more like the idea of the old style British copper. That's the kind of idea we had in the old days before all of this started happening. And again, that's interesting because quite often private security companies have got a bit of a bad reputation, at least anecdotally. It's very interesting to hear that they're taking on that kind of role.
Yeah, and I think that the real key here is that once the app launches and hopefully is used on a larger scale, I think that there are going to be more and more police departments which are shut down because of the number of lawsuits against them. And I think that it's at these moments that's really key for people in a community to band together and push for something. And it may be pretty much impossible to influence anything on a larger level, but on a local level, if there are enough people in a community, they really can make a change on that local level. Something like for example, concerning whether or not to have a government-run police department or to contract those services out to private security force. And if we can start getting more police departments just simply fired and then replaced with something that is actually accountable to the people that they're actually trying to protect, then I think that that's really how we start to steer off the course that we're currently on. And we are on a course that I think that if we don't change things and enact the right solutions, and I'm not saying that Sidekick is just that solution, it's just one part, and there are a lot of other projects that other people are working on that are equally as much, if not more so, valuable than the Sidekick app.
Yeah, well, you mentioned, well for a start off, a lot of the things we've been discussing are actually a kind of suite of indicators of potential solutions, and you mentioned CopBlock. I've been watching videos from them as well. I think that their website is called copblock.org. That again is proving to be pretty successful, isn't it?
Oh yes, CopBlock is really, you know, they've been doing really good work for years now, and I think that ever since, it was steadily, their viewer base was steadily increasing before the Ferguson riots, but I think that was really a trigger. And they passed a million likes on Facebook, and a lot of people really follow them because they've established themselves and have a very trusted reputation, and they have a network too, where people can establish their own, you know, cop block groups within their given town or region. And these people can act a lot of times like reporting. Right. They, yeah. they have their own cameras and they do their filming, and it all gets sent to the CopBlock website. And so they're able to capture a lot more of what's actually happening than was available for public viewing before.
Well, certainly, because sometimes you've got two or three people filming the same thing from different angles, and they also seem to be giving a fair degree of guidance and training as to the kind of the kind of behavior that's needed, the kind of information that might be useful. It looks like, again, looks like a thoroughly beneficial approach to me.
Oh, yes, I really like what they've just started recently. They had first called it CopBlock Protection. I think they've switched it over to CopBlock Networking. But it's a service that they'll provide that people can, it's actually, I guess you could say it's similar to Sidekick in terms of the payments. So you would basically make like a small monthly payment. And then if you ever get in trouble, right, if you ever if you're, you know, falsely arrested for, you know, something, then they'll have somebody travel to you and assist you basically while your life's crumbling, because that's typically what happens when people get caught up in the system. And at the same time, develop original content with, to counter, you know, if there's a mainstream media, slant to this person's story, then CopBlock can create their own content and have it compete with that. And, and even if it's maybe the case is on a smaller scale and it's not being put out in the news, then CopBlock can still make that original content. And it just makes, it makes the public awareness it increases public awareness in what's actually going on with the interaction between the public and the police.
And again, when we were talking about your friend's court case and about the Milgram experiment, we realized that that's one of the main places that we need to be seeing a difference made.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, there are training methods that can be instituted, which really at least largely eliminate that type of, and I would call it sadism. I think that's probably the best definition of it.
Yeah.
You know, taking pleasure and inflicting, you know, pain on other people. And I think that training can really set up a lot of barriers so that people don't slip into that role if they are acting in this protector or security role. You know, so they don't start to think of themselves as better than the people that they're supposed to be protecting.
Yeah, which seems to be a pretty much automatic response for some reason.
Yes.
I think that, I mean, another thing we're hitting on here, which seems to me to be key to many solutions is, I mean, decentralization is a word that covers it well, but I like to think of it as, at the moment we seem to have kind of huge overriding, kind of government overviews, whereas things that work well seem to be made up of a whole collection of small things that work well individually and then work well together. And it seems to me to be what we're seeing developing here.
Yeah, and I think that that's the clash between the two antithetical systems of, you know, individualism and collectivism, or, you know, it's basically, I like to think of it in terms of points of power. So the more collectivized the system is, the more centralized, the easier it is to influence other people if you control this one position at the top, which,
yeah.
Right. So the more that we can break down those points of power, I think the better off we're going to be, the safer we're going to be, the more stable the overall system is.
Yeah. So we find ourselves in a position where somebody that's being subjected to a roadside stop can call an attorney who then represents them or presents them at the roadside, because of course the individual ideally shouldn't really be talking to the police because it's not normally in their interest, is it?
No, it's not. In the US, the police are trained to engage in small talk with people as a means of getting incriminating evidence against them. So it's generally not a good idea to talk to police. And that's the overall point here, is just once you tell your attorney what's going on, you know, such as I've been pulled over, or I'm walking down the sidewalk, or CPS agents are at my house and they want to take my kids, what have you, you just tell your attorney what's happening and then hold up the phone and really just be quiet, because as I've been told by one defense attorney, most of my clients talk themselves into jail.
Yeah, yes, we're very much aware of that on People's Internet Radio. We say that because it's the same, I think, with police pretty much everywhere now. They're trained to get you to cede jurisdiction to them, and then you're about stuffed, really.
Right, and I think that that's why it's so important to have the third party there. There, you know, the audio video recording is really important, but I think it's just so key to have a knowledgeable third party, because they're far less likely to get emotional, or they're far more likely also to stay rational and stay on topic and stay to what's important. You know, asking questions like, who are you? What's your badge number? What department are you claiming to be from? I need to check and see that you're actually a police officer. Why did you pull my client over?
Yeah.
And there are codes written into each state which say what the officer can and can't do in a given situation. So, you know, the attorneys are really just there to, you know, make sure that the officer goes by those codes. And if they don't, then it's documented, and the attorney will know what they're looking at.
Yeah.
And Right.
And I guess the better they perform on these calls, the more leads they're going to be generating for themselves.
Exactly. And attorneys, you know, we're going to have a rating system, or the real key here is quality control. We need to make sure, A, that every time that somebody wants an attorney, that they can have an attorney, given that they actually, you know, even have enough reception, right? But beyond that, it's also that the attorneys are high quality, that they've thoroughly familiarized themselves with the codes of the state they're licensed in, that they've gone through, that they've really walked through everything, and that they know their role is to represent the client to the best of their abilities, and make them aware that there are measures in place, such as rating systems, to ensure that the quality continues on.
Yeah, and then of course the person that's being, or the individual that's being subjected to the attentions of the authorities, can subsequently choose, I guess, whether they want somebody to represent them in court or whether they go in and present themselves. Do people automatically take on attorneys in the States, or do you have people presenting themselves as litigants in person?
There are people who file pro se, and they're just by themselves. But I think that, you know, really the general default that people go to is to get an attorney if they find themselves in a situation like that, you know, whether it's a DUI or, you know, taxes or what have you.
So actually, I mean, these other things you're mentioning suggest that this app could be really widely applied. We're not just talking about the roadside stop.
No, we're talking again, you know, I don't know what the situation is like with this in Ireland and the UK, but in the US, it's basically just been going up and up, which is child kidnapping by the state through Child Protective Services.
Yeah, it's massive here. It's massive.
Really? Okay. Man, it's absolutely horrible, and this could be used there too. There are code sections and policies which determine, which govern the CPS agent's behavior. And the attorneys will be familiarized with this. So there are a few key sections of interactions that people have with the state that we are compiling the code sections for, and the attorneys will need to know all that. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that it's actually not it's not an overwhelming amount of material. It shouldn't take too long for an attorney to really get to know the relevant codes. So that whether it's a traffic stop or CPS agents at the door, or, you know, even a city code inspector, right, saying you need to pay for this permit, right? You need to stop work, right? The attorney will overall know how to deal with that.
I guess it's not unreasonable to think that some attorneys might choose to actually specialize in this kind of activity, and we might see an improvement in the record of attorneys in court as well, because they're going to have better evidence to work with, aren't they?
Yes, and I think there are going to be a lot of attorneys who specialize in this once they see how much better of a business model it is than either working at a traditional law firm, you know, slaving away, or also versus the older style of a lead generation business model. Instead of just, you know, calling all these people or emailing them, and it's just somebody who's put in their name and phone number and said, I want to be contacted by an attorney, they don't have to deal with that anymore. So I think it's going to make for a lot of home attorneys.
Yeah.
Right? There are people who, you know, graduate law school, they pass the bar, and in the U.S. they have just tons and tons of loan debt, and it's very difficult for them to get a job at a law firm, and a lot of them even have trouble getting jobs as a paralegal. And so they have to go into other fields. But they're still saddled with all this debt, and I think this will be a good solution for them. All they have to do is just brush up on the codes, make sure they have a good enough webcam, a good enough internet connection, and if they have all that, then they can just operate out of their house and just log in and signal that they're ready to take calls and take calls to their heart's content.
Yeah, and it's been my feeling for some time that there must be a significant number of policemen and attorneys and judges within the system who would like to see the system operating more as it's supposed to, rather than as it appears to be operating at the moment. And this is an opportunity for them really to step out of the shadows, isn't it?
I think it is. And I think that's a really good point, is that they're not all bad. Whether you're talking about judges or cops or DAs, although not so much on the DA part.
I must admit, it's one of the things I'm thinking about is we know in this country that the lawyers work fundamentally for the law and the court, and they've got oaths they take that are not necessarily in the public service. And so we're slightly nervous about taking them on, the people on People's Internet Radio. There's a tendency for us to prefer litigation in person if it can be done that way. But I'm pretty convinced that that could change.
I agree. I think that with the proper incentive, it could change. And I think that Sidekick could at very least be part of that incentive. I'm not saying that this app is the whole solution. I do think it's a step in the right direction, but there are other technologies that are already developed and being developed which also deal with other effects of the police state. There's one app called Peacekeeper, which makes it so that people can create closed communities. So instead of, let's say that you're out of town and you need to check on your elderly grandfather who's in a nursing home, but you haven't heard from him for a little bit. This isn't like a weird scenario. This has happened several times in the U.S. very recently, where the family member doesn't have a community set in place, but they still want their family member checked on. They'll call the police, and this has happened in old folks' homes. This has happened with teenagers with some kind of mental disorder have gone off their medication. That's a really common one. And the police show up, and in short order, that person's shot dead. And so we can help lower the inclination and the dependence on police by forming stronger communities. And these stronger communities used to exist. They've largely been destroyed, but we can rebuild them. And Peacekeeper is a tool to expedite that rebuilding. So you and a circle of friends or family members can download the app and join each other on a closed community so that you can send out all different types of alerts, like I think my home is being broken into, or, the cops just showed up, or could you go check on so-and-so, I'm out of town. It may not be dealing with the police directly, but it does deal with it indirectly.
That's absolutely brilliant, because one of the main things that my show, that Dr. Rock's radio show, likes to concentrate on is the idea that we need to rebuild community and communications between ourselves, because it is the loss of that, I feel, as much as anything else, that is enabling authorities to take advantage of us, really, this kind of this tendency to break down rather than work towards synthesis.
Right. Yes, I agree. And I think that a big step in this is the decentralization of society. And a lot of it has to do with technology. So I'm not sure how much you or your listeners follow Bitcoin or the blockchain technology. But once we combine that with decentralized data storage, we're well on the way toward having a completely decentralized internet, which much stronger, far harder to destroy. And if we can have other aspects of society begin to tend toward decentralization, then I think if we can cross a tipping point by doing so, then I think I'm positive about the future. If we can get enough people developing, supporting, or spreading the word about decentralized technologies that are overall trying to push us in the right direction.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I must admit, I'm finding this a very, very exciting conversation, and actually one of the most optimistic ones I've had for a long time, because you look out on the world and see the way things are going, but have known for a long time that the technologies can as well be made to work for us. It's really great to hear that it does seem to be happening out there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Technologies like surveillance cameras, for example, have been demonized, and stuff like fingerprint scanners and iris scanners, GPS locators. These are just tools. And so far, the powers that be, whatever you want to call them, in the U.S., so it's mainly run by the NSA, but pretty much all these alphabet soup government agencies use it, and that's surveillance. They use this technology to wipe away our privacy and track us, and it doesn't have to be that way. These technologies can be used on the other side of the spectrum as well. It's just a tool. Someone could use a hammer to build a house or kill somebody.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with it? So these tools are far along, and I think that there are a lot of technologies available right now that could really be used in a more decentralized manner, and it would really, really help out the basic cause for human freedom.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair and useful point to be made. So your app sounds fairly complicated. How close are you to having it complete?
Well, we raised enough capital in the first crowdfunding campaign to complete the first phase of app development. So this is all the technical feasibility studies, technical planning, wireframing, a fluid user interface, app screen graphics, and some coding. The next stage is full coding. So in terms of the overall percentage of how far along we are in the process, I'd say maybe 25%, probably about a quarter of the way there. I wish it were further, but I can only go so far as much capital as I can raise. And I'm not trying to say this as a plea for people to, you know, contribute money or anything. I'm giving this as kind of a reason of why it's not farther along in the process. But I partnered with an excellent software development company, and they're basically standing by because they've just recently completed the first phase. And we started a Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign just this morning. So once we build up enough funding, then I'll go ahead and continue working with Zico on further development of the app.
Is there a website we can point people to so that they can keep track of or maybe donate to this project?
Sure. The website is sidekickapp.com, and that's spelled S-I-D-E-K-I-K. So there's no C in kick. So sidekickapp.com. And from there, they can read an FAQ, they can watch a video, they can see some of the app screens, the actual app screen graphics that I've put up on the homepage. They can read through a list of some of the features. They can contact me if people have any questions. I'm happy to answer any questions I get. And there's also a link, crowdfunding, which takes people to the Indiegogo profile. And then for people who want to contribute using Bitcoin, if they click on contribute, then they can do so through Bitcoin. And I took everything off 10% from the contribution levels on Indiegogo because Bitcoin doesn't have the high transaction fees. Mm-hmm. And basically what happens is, let's say that somebody puts in $100, then they'll get 3 years of subscription to Sidekick, so 36 calls. And they can keep it all to themselves, or they could split it among other people, so 1 year for themselves and another year for two other people each. So I wanted to make sure that people were, you know, at least getting something, or at least the promise of something. And that's really what it is. People are putting their trust and faith in me that if they put their money into the project, that I'll use it wisely. And I really tried to get across that point by using every last penny from the first crowdfunding campaign and put everything toward the app. So now people can see, okay, you, for the people who put in money last time, this is what I did with it. You can see the results. And now it's time to move forward. We need to have another crowdfunding campaign to continue development. And so if people can see that, I'm going to be using the money wisely, and I've already demonstrated that, then I think they'll be more likely to contribute. And also if they're getting something out of it, so a subscription to the very service that they're helping create.
Yeah. And how easy would it be? I mean, obviously you're working on the United States and the attorney system there. How easy do you think it would be to transfer the system to other nation states or public limited companies or whatever we want to call them?
Yes, and this is weighing pretty heavily on my mind. In the first campaign, I was contacted by people from all over the world.
You don't surprise me, especially Canada. Yeah. They're having a pretty wicked time up there, aren't they?
Oh yeah. I was contacted by people from Canada, people from the UK, it's kind of like people from South Korea, different places in Europe, the Caribbean. I mean, I was really surprised that, for example, I would get contacted by somebody from the U.S. Virgin Islands who's telling me that there is a police state in the U.S. Virgin Islands. You know, the overall message I got is that this is not a localized event.
No, I think it's pretty global what we're experiencing, which is one of the reasons why I think it's important to act pretty promptly on it, really.
It is global. It has slightly different forms in different areas, but the overall theme is the same, and it is global. And as far as branching out to other countries, I definitely plan on doing that once I've proven the model and established it in the U.S. I would want to branch out first to the Commonwealth countries. I think it would make for the easiest transition. But there are also plenty of other countries, India, Russia, China, really big countries, big populations, and there's a lot of, corruption and graft in those places, just like in the U.S. and Canada and the U.K. and Ireland and Australia and New Zealand. I mean, it's pretty much everywhere. I really do want to branch out, and the technology will stay the same. It's really a matter of aggregating the relevant code sections and then developing the attorney network, basically by going through the different legal organizations which exist and account for many or most of the attorneys in a given area.
As a matter of interest, have you had any kind of response or interference or any kind of interaction at all with government, police, or other authorities on the subject of what you're trying to do?
No, I haven't. The most I've had are trolls, just trolls who basically go after, comment sections and try and, if there's an article written about the app, then there'll typically be a decent amount of trolls. But I don't really like to follow that kind of stuff. And other than that, in terms of actual physical interactions or any type of harassment, I could be surveilled. I have no idea. But I haven't noticed anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the more trolls you're attracting, the more signs of success you're generating, really.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully I'm past the first stage of an idea being accepted. I guess being ignored is the first stage. Or is that the second stage? Anyway, I think, whatever it is, right now it just basically feels like I'm being ignored, and that's great. That's what I want.
Yeah.
Especially at this stage of development for the app.
So what's your best case guess on when you might see it actually working for you in the US?
Well, it all depends on capital. So if I can raise enough to complete app development in one straight shot, which would be about $130,000 for the whole app, from the time of continuing development, we could have the app finished, cleared through beta testing, and available on through iOS and Android probably by the third quarter of this year.
Wow, $130,000, that's absolutely nothing when you consider that your defense department lost $9 trillion one year.
Right. I mean, it is a lot of money, and even the amounts that people are contributing, that's also a lot of money. The fact is that we're in hard times, and, $5, $10, $20, it makes a difference. So I really appreciate when people contribute that money. And the fact is that the overall goal, $130,000 to complete the app, that's a lot of money. It's a very complex application, but it is doable. And if a few thousand people would contribute, the average contribution has been a little under $100 for the last campaign. So if a few thousand people would chip in, I'm not saying everybody needs to put in $100, but it's really interesting how it works out for every, group of people who say, okay, I want to contribute, but I don't have much. Here's 10, here's 20. There's somebody who puts in, 250 or 500, and it all evens out.
Mm. Well, that's absolutely marvelous, Orion. I'd really like to thank you for all of that information. I think it's been one of the most optimistic and solution-based chats that I've had for a long time. I've really enjoyed it. I'm very grateful for you putting aside some time to talk to us about it.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me on your show and contacting me in the first place. Okay. All right.
Thanks a lot for all the work you're doing as well. I mean, absolutely 10 out of 10 to you, mate. You're a beacon of hope, sir. Well done.
Hey, and congratulations to you too. I like the work that you're doing. I perused through it and found it very interesting.
Great. Well, thank you very, very much indeed. And I'm sure we'll chat again sometime in the future when it's if ever you've got something that you want to put out there, give me a shout and we'll have another chat.
Ah, great. Thanks a lot.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ryan. I'll speak again.
Yes. Talk to you later.
Good afternoon, mate. Bye bye.
You too.
Dr. Rock's radio show, seeking solutions on peoplesinternetradio.com.